Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Amanda Palmer used to work as a human statue, the 8-foot bride. She stood on a milk box in Harvard Square, dressed in a wedding gown. When someone stopped to give her money, she'd offer them a daisy and an opportunity to connect face to face, soul to soul. She asked, people gave, and the result was human connection. And that basic bargain continues, and with it, Palmer has earned success and sometimes sparked controversy. Today, she's an internationally renowned artist, famous for her rock music, but equally famous for her work with crowdfunding. She raised more than $1 million from 25,000 people on Kickstarter, the most successful music project in the site's history. She talked about all of this, about asking and trusting, at a TED Talk early last year that went viral.
My music career has been spent trying to encounter people on the internet the way I could on the box. So blogging and tweeting, not just about my tour dates and my new video, but about our work and our art and our fears and our hangovers, our mistakes, and we see each other. And I think when we really see each other, we want to help each other. I think people have been obsessed with the wrong question, which is, how do we make people pay for music? What if we started asking, how do we let people pay for music?
More than 6 million people have watched that TED Talk, and out of it has come a new book from Amanda Palmer called The Art of Asking, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Let People Help. Amanda Palmer will be performing tonight at Royale in Boston, and she's with us now. And Amanda, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it was really fun to read your book. And I want to ask you about your TED Talk on The Art of Asking that went viral. I'm wondering why you think this topic hit such a nerve, and boy, did it.
Yeah, that was actually, that was the starting point for the book, because I aimed the TED Talk basically at my artist and musician friends who seemed to have a really hard time asking, especially with the new internet economy and crowdfunding, and all of a sudden all of this direct connection. Mm. And a lot of artists and audiences have a hard time with that, because usually there's someone in the middle doing the deals for us.
Right.
And I was seeing a lot of artists really having trouble directly asking people to give them money and help them. And even though that's where the TED Talk was aimed, it seemed to hit everybody else. And it was that cultural nerve that sort of made me perk up and say, maybe there's something deeper to explore here. Why does it seem like everybody I'm running into on every street corner and in every cafe and in every airport is pulling me aside saying, wow, Your talk really hit something, and I also have a really hard time asking.
And why do you think that is? Why? Because it seems to come very naturally to you. And what I loved about that TED Talk, and we'll talk more about this, but it seems like you embraced asking. You embrace asking as an opportunity to connect.
Sure. I mean, the big hypocrisy, and I explore it deeply in the book, is that even though I found it really easy to ask millions of people to help me fund an album, I was simultaneously struggling at home just taking help from my husband in different departments. And I think everybody has their own Achilles heels and their own hang-ups. And I say it in the talk, asking is a risk. Asking fundamentally makes you vulnerable, whether you're asking for love or for money or for help. And it's funny, I mean, it was such a huge net of a topic that every single person, especially while I was writing the book in a really condensed couple of months, everybody I talked to had a story, from teenage girls to businessmen in their 70s. Everybody had a story either about making themselves vulnerable and asking and being rejected and devastated, or how some part of their life really clicked into place when they were able to make themselves vulnerable and ask for help. And I think the big theme that I plucked out is that when you see a culture that's really afraid of asking, I think it points a little bit to our fundamental disconnect with each other. Because in these weird ways with the internet and in cities, you know, it's as if we appear really connected to each other. But in certain ways, we're really not, and we're really afraid of each other.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, this technology, it provides the mechanism to make the ask, to ask, but maybe it also puts up a shield. I mean, it sort of puts up a barrier, right?
Well, I mean, I'm a pretty perfect example. I wasn't exactly always celebrated for going out and asking for help. I was also really reviled and ridiculed.
Sure.
Even just, I mean, all other things beside, even just the act of using Kickstarter made people hate me. And before anything else happened, I was sort of labeled like an online beggar. And, you know, people were really down on me for
it's just so
using
interesting.
It.
And you make the point that this gets back to this very first thing that you did, the sort of piece of art when you were the 8-foot bride. And one of the things you say in the TED Talk is people would drive by you and say, hey, get a job.
Right. And I was doing my, it was a weird job, right? But I was doing my job, even if my job was standing on a box with a hat at my feet.
Right.
And I think, I mean, there's some great poetry in there, which is, it wasn't a normal exchange, but it worked for me and it worked for the people, you know, who were on their daily commute, who kind of loved this weird spontaneous interaction with the street performer. And everybody was getting something out of it, even though it was a little messy. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like going into CVS and buying a toothbrush for $6.99.
So what did that experience teach you? Was that it? That in asking and then someone giving, there's this human connection? I mean, what did that experience teach you about this whole thing?
Well, I mean, my experience as a street performer taught me a lot about trusting humanity. I mean, even just the act of standing on a box and being vulnerable to the weather and to the passersby, and also basically being ignored by pretty much everybody. I mean, when you're a busker and you're standing there on the street, whether you're a statue or a musician or a juggler, 99% of the population is actively ignoring you. They have to kind of go out of their way to ignore you or walk around you. And so it really, as a performer, it really gives you balls of steel. And then, you know, and then all of us getting up on stage in a theater seems easy after that because everybody is paid to be there and is there to actually watch you. And most of the street performers and, you know, buskers I know are fearless performers and askers because they've sort of learned the language of allowing, you know, that small sliver or slice of population who are engaged, that your energy is spent welcoming them in and being, you know, and feeling gratitude towards them, not worrying about the other 99% who don't like you or are just walking by ignoring you.
Amanda Palmer, I'd love to ask you, for people who aren't as familiar with your music career, describe how this simple idea of exchange has informed the kind of relationship you have with your fan base.
Well, I mean, it started off, my band started at a really interesting point in history around 2000 where not everybody had email. Not every band had a website. MySpace didn't exist yet. Social networking didn't exist yet. And we were doing proto-social networking, which every band I saw growing up was doing, which is, you know, mailing lists and flyers and tons of word of mouth. And, you know, as the Dresden Dolls were playing in every club in Boston, from the Lizard Lounge to the Middle East every weekend. And when the internet came along, it seemed like a really simple, obvious extension of what we were already doing in our sort of DIY grassroots fan base, which is like, take every opportunity possible, sometimes get paid, sometimes don't, and get everybody's email and expand our community. And with each tool that developed on the internet, from MySpace to Facebook to email lists to my blog and now Twitter, it seemed like a kind of a logical extension of this community that we were building. And the Dresden Dolls weren't a band that were ever bent on being pop stars or having any commercial success. We really wanted to be a family. And, you know, we didn't have sort of Madonna-level goals. You know, we wanted to be a working, you know, band who didn't have to have day jobs. And, you know, and the internet is fascinating to me as far as it comes to our daily lives, but also bands, because it basically is just a bunch of people doing things the way they've always done them, which is making connections, creating community, finding likeness, resonating with each other. But, you know, the tools of the internet nowadays are really dangerous because then you also get that freaky flip side where you can either get lost in it or you can also, you know, be easily misunderstood.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about that in a moment, but let me first ask you about this phenomenal Kickstarter campaign. You raised about $1.2 million from nearly 25,000 contributors, which was phenomenal, especially at that time. What led you to ask your fans for this kind of help making an album in the first place?
Well, I spent a number of years on a major label, and I really didn't like the experience. And by the time I had put out my third record with a major label and was really and was really starting to realize how much of a product I was and how little the label actually cared about my career and how little they cared about my fans as well. And, you know, the seamy underside really started to show. I struggled to get off the label, and I detail the struggle in my book. It's pretty funny, actually. And when I got off the label, I had a choice. I could sign with another label. I could try and find a sort of a more benevolent indie label, or I could go it alone. And at that point, it was just that sort of critical mass of direct tools available to an artist my size that I sort of looked at it and weighed my options and said, you know, I think my fans will help me if I just print this record myself. I think I might be better off than trying to negotiate with a label who's going to take 95% of the profit and possibly not even help me or understand me or them. And it was just the perfect place and the perfect time. Kickstarter was just sort of coming into the giant public consciousness, and people were really excited to use it. But it was also misunderstood, and I think Kickstarter still to this day is sort of misunderstood, especially when, you know, people ask me what I did with the $1 million. I don't think they realize that it was $1 million worth of record pre-orders.
Where's your boat moored?
Exactly. And, I mean, people are also fascinated by the fact that I pretty much broke even on that Kickstarter. Yeah. I took that $1 million and I basically printed up $1 million worth of records and merchandise and sent it to my fans with free postage, which wound up being a huge miscalculation. So I didn't make a huge profit, but I did, again, sort of draw my fan base closer to me. And those 25,000 people, which by label standards isn't a lot, really appreciated it.
But where's the disconnect? I mean, I'm trying to understand when people sort of had trouble with the idea of Amanda Palmer raising $1 million+ on Kickstarter. I mean, I'm trying to understand where the disconnect was, because why is it not a problem to, you know, to raise that kind of money with the help of a middleman and a label? And yet we have a problem with, what, you just went right to directly to the people and took out the middleman? Shame on you.
I think direct connection at a lot of levels makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, we could get into a long philosophical conversation about capitalism here, but I discovered something while I was writing my book that really floored me, which was, so I got in trouble also for inviting my fans to volunteer and play at my shows.
Right, in exchange for beers and hugs.
Right, which was something that I had been, and the Dresden Dolls had been doing for years and years, which is like find local talent, invite them to the show, give them tickets, have them busk, have them help, have them, you know, guest on stage with us. And I caught a lot of flack for that. And I didn't understand why, because as far as I was concerned, these people were volunteers and they volunteered their time and energy of their own free will. And then I found someone sent me a link to a Kickstarter that had gone up right around the same time as mine by a band called the Polyphonic Spree. And they had done something similar, except instead of not paying their volunteers, they charged $1,500 as a Kickstarter package. And what you got with that package was their album and a bunch of merchandise, and you got to get up on stage and play with the band for $1,500. And they sold 10 of those packages, and nobody had any problem with that. Yeah. And that kind of untied the mystery for me, because I was like, okay, I get it. If I'm paying my fans, it's okay. If my fans are paying me, it's okay. But somehow, if it's an exchange in the gray area where what's being exchanged isn't money, people are freaking out. And that, I thought that spoke volumes.
Well, I want to ask about sort of where this whole thing leads. I mean, this great thing you did on Kickstarter. I mean, is this the future of music? And do you think that record labels don't need to exist anymore at all?
Well, I think the future of music is going to be a million different paths for artists. I see, especially with what just happened with Taylor Swift and what just happened with U2 forcing their music onto iTunes. I think the big cultural problem that everybody is having right now is that all the commentators and all the critics believe that there's going to be one solution and that all these artists aren't quite getting it right. Whereas I think the answer is going to be there's just going to be a massive amount of diversity, and I'm going to be doing it one way, maybe with crowdfunding. Taylor Swift is going to be doing it one way with the label. U2 is going to be, you know, making a deal with iTunes or Spotify. Radiohead is going to be doing this. Trent Reznor is going to be doing this. Lorde is going to be doing this. And that every single one of those paths is okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you as the consumer, as the audience, you have the choice who you want to support and how. And the artist has the choice how they want to interact, directly, indirectly, using an advocate, using a label. And the public doesn't seem to have a whole lot of patience for a lot of different artists using a lot of different systems. But I think that that's going to be the ultimate solution.
You know, in this book, which reads a lot like memoir, you've got a lot of wisdom about asking and about this art of asking. And you include this great quote from Tip O'Neill, which I love. If you want to make someone your friend, ask them a favor.
It's really true.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, I when I found that quote, I loved it because it's basically, it distills the message of the book, which is that asking becomes your relationship. Mm-hmm. Asking is the relationship. It's kind of this strange chicken and egg question of, you know, do you build up a relationship and then you finally are close enough to somebody to be able to ask them for help or to water your plants or feed your cat or, you know.
But you're saying the asking actually is and builds the relationship.
The asking is the relationship.
That's great.
And the more I thought about my life and looked around at the relationships in my life and my friends' relationships to each other or to their spouses, you almost can define your relationship and your intimacy with others by what you're able to ask them. And in fact, like, if you ask around, like, how do you define your close friends? How do you define your intimate relationships? It's pretty much like a lot of people have said, well, you know, if you wound up in jail, who would you call? Like, who's on that, like, speed dial list of people that you're not afraid to ask for help? And that's a really interesting lens through which to look at relationships in life.
So we're practically out of time, but I want to ask this. I need to ask. There's like 10 seconds left. You write that the art of asking can be learned, studied, and perfected. So are you there? Are you still perfecting the art of asking?
No way, man. Total work in progress till I die.
Amanda Palmer, she's a musician and author of the new book, The Art of Asking, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Let People Help. She'll be performing tonight at Royale in Boston. A lot more information, including a link to that great TED Talk that Amanda did at RadioBoston.org. Amanda Palmer, thank you very much. What a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you. And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR Boston, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.